Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming. We're going to be in Nehemiah chapter 4. I got a lot of things I'd like to cover tonight. I know we're limited on time and I'd like to read the text, so we'll see how this all comes together. I do want to point out that we did send the book into print, so that is, it's a go. It took exactly 5 months from the day we kind of introduced the concept on a Sunday until we sent it in Saturday night and the printer sent it back. Wanted a couple corrections. We sent it back then Sunday right away. Just one of the pictures was colored, and it should have been black and white, so we just had to change that, and Clint changed a couple other things. So it's a done deal now. It's just a matter of he'll print off a set of proofs and ship them to me. I'll look at them, have to sign off on them. Then they'll run 3,000 copies. So it's, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I mean, a matter of getting it all done. And they'll box them up and then they'll ship them by semi. And about a semi pull into the neighborhood, which is always exciting. And we'll unload them into our warehouse. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And once they find out I'm running a publishing house from my wood shop in my garage that Tony hasn't been able to use for 15 years, they may have a building code or something violation. But nonetheless, that's good. And so we should have some books here. And it looks good. I mean, I'm not sure if you like the content or not, but the cover looks really cool. You're going to want the book just because the cover looks cool. And so anyway, we're going to be talking about Nehemiah. I'm going to start passing this around right here. This is a photo that's taken. This map right here, if you take a look at this, this is, the temple. This is the city of David. Does anybody still need a map? I've got some maps up here of, anybody still need this? Here, Tony, you want to grab these? And I've got three or four maps here. And this might be, this is what's in the new book. I think the new book has got that copy in it. That's a good copy. Here's the ridge. This is the original city of David right here. This was the Jebusite city. And then the palace of the Jebusites was apparently right here. David occupied it, rebuilt it. It's still called the large stone structure. They can still see, we've been in there. We've walked through it. It's the remains of people argue about everything. But it's the royal residence of the kings of Judah. That was the stronghold of the Jebusites that they just kept building on. Nehemiah is going to occupy this. This is going to kind of be rebuilt and occupied by Nehemiah. In fact, there's been, like we said, a boule of his daughter's name there that had Persian symbols on it from this time period. So it appears that he was there. Some of the boule that were found from Jeremiah's day, with the names of the people that persecuted Jeremiah, were found just below this. This is the Kidron Valley here, so this is a slope down. And so they found the boule that were there with the names of people from the book of Jeremiah that persecuted Jeremiah, official seals that would be belonged to. And their names and their father's names were on the seal, just like it is in the Bible. And so this is pretty clearly the palace. I mean, there's a just assume that that's correct. You can argue that if you want to, but there's really no point of arguing it. Solomon expanded the city up this way. This is the Ophel. That's just kind of a little bit, it means the rise up until the top of Mount Moriah where the bedrock is exposed. This is where the temple was at that they rebuilt then. The Dome of the Rock sits right here today. These are the gates. You've got the east gate, the prison gate, the sheep gate, because this is the sheep pool right up here, the Pool of Bethesda. The fish gate, probably because you're going towards the Mediterranean Sea, the fish is coming in here. The old gate here, or Jeshana gate here, Ephraim gate. There's the broad wall, as mentioned, when we talk about the working on the broad wall. This part still remains. This is the broad wall built by Hezekiah to expand the city in 700 BC. So they went by this when they were working on it last week, talked about the broad wall. This part is still there. You can still see this, visually go and see this part of it. It's been excavated, called the broad wall. It looks about like that. And so you get a real good picture of it. And so that would be, this would have come over like this, gone down like this, and then would have continued over here in Hezekiah's day. The ovens here, the oven gate right here, or the ovens were located in this area. The valley gate, why the valley gate? Because this is the central valley. Then the Hinnom Valley comes over here. So you go down into the central valley. A lot of this is covered up today. It's been flattened with rubble, but also on purpose so that it's easier to access this side of the city or this part of the city. So the valley gate coming down here, the jackal well, which is the Pool of Siloam. the dung gate, the fountain gate, which is where the king's gardens would be, because this is the Gihon Springs right here, and that would have watered this area here. There was a Canaanite tunnel coming down this way. The Hezekiah's tunnel kind of cuts through here, something like this, and dumps into here. Even today, and we walk through this tunnel underground here, and follow the water from the Gihon Springs. It just rushes out. It's cold. It's clear. And you just follow the water through Hezekiah's tunnel into this right here, which is the Pool of Siloam. It was called the Jackal Well at that time. This is a bad map right here. Yeah, that's why. Because it took me about 4 or 5 years to get through this. And this, if you look in the old book, they've got those over here. Correct. This is the new. Yeah, and you can find several things online as people have researched this. But no, that's. Yeah. And you can find 2 or 3 maps online with Generation Word on it. And this is the latest. This, I think, is in the new book, the framework book. Yeah, this was Hezekiah's wall. At one time, we were trying to put it over into here. But anyway, this isn't here. This was all destroyed and wasn't rebuilt. Nehemiah doesn't rebuild all the wall. He rebuilds the wall around the main part of the city. This was... Okay, anyway. So anyway, this is Gihon Springs. And the reason I'm saying this is right here, there's a water gate right here. That sounds funny. The water gate right here, which is just below the palace. And right in this area, this is where this is taken. In fact, if you look at this, this part is right here with the Jebusite wall supporting the stone, large stone structure right here. So right in this area is where you'll see this. I'm going to pass it around. This is in the Jerusalem book. This was part of Nehemiah's wall that was rebuilt. Again, it does have Nehemiah's name on it, but you can date the Jebusite structure. You can date certain structures that were built during the Hasmonean period. This was built around the time of Nehemiah. So this would be, you asking last week what you thought the wall would look like. This would be kind of the structure. And you can see, if you're familiar with the Asher stones that were used by Herod that had the nice margin around them and everything was really neat, this is a little more, it's still straight, it's still standing, it's a little more stuck together. But it's still very, very straight. This was most likely, we're not sure, but they date this to Nehemiah's time. I'll pass this around. This is in the Jerusalem book. Okay, with that being said, I want to go to, if you have your framework books, you can be on page 146. Again, we're just looking at these years. From the year 445 to 433, I've got 2 verses I'd like to look at. First, in chapter 5, verse 14, just to give us a reference here. Now remember, Ezra has come back before Nehemiah. So Ezra has been back and he's been working. Nehemiah comes back because nothing is getting done. Nothing is being done as far as the city. The temple is up and running. Ezra's back trying to get things organized, but they're not building anything. So Nehemiah has permission from Artaxerxes to come back, and basically he's going to be the governor of the city. And we're going to read some things about governorship. Now, you can talk all you want to about, all the spiritual things, but we're going to get some chapters here where Nehemiah is basically just taking charge of the city. He's pushing God's plan forward. And they've got opposition from the Samaritans. They've got opposition from the Ammonites. We're going to read about that. But in chapter 5, verse 14... I'm reading just randomly grabbing this verse here. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, until his 32nd year, so that's 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate food allotted to the governor. So that's going to be an issue. He's going to be coming up here. He's going to talk about how his integrity compared to others that had come before him and some of the problems they had of oppressing the poor. We're going to get into that a little bit. But what we're looking at here is the date. So he's going to be in Jerusalem. He's going to be appointed in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. So when he brings the wine and he's talking to Artaxerxes, Artaxerxes has been on the throne for up to 20 years. And then he's going to get a 12-year permission to come over and be the governor with the main point of being... Now again, he doesn't start the book off saying, I was appointed governor. He talks about, I was appointed to build the wall. He's going to come back and help his people. He is your servant coming back to rebuild the walls. little do you know, he is actually the governor. He'd been appointed the governor, but he does come in with military personnel. He comes in with the horses. He comes in and begins to take over with letters. He's opposed by the Samaritans and the Amorites, and he says, hey, I've got documentation. You want to talk to Artaxerxes, you're going to have to go through me because I work for him. So they realize they've kind of got a situation. They can't lie to Artaxerxes because he is like the vice president. He is like under his jurisdiction. And so Artaxerxes knows him in I would even say, in a, I don't want to use the word friendly way, but he knows him as a man. He knows him as a confidant. He knows him as someone that's in his palace talking with him. So when someone sends an evil report about Nehemiah, Artaxerxes is like, no, that's not what I know Nehemiah. And so it's really hard to break into the Jews at this time because the Persians have control. Nehemiah works for the emperor, and people that are lying about Nehemiah, it's kind of like there's no traction. They can't get any traction on him as far as bringing accusations against him. Okay, so he's there for 12 years. Now I want to go to chapter 13, verse 6. Here's another date in the book of Nehemiah. Chapter 13, verse 6 and 7. And again, some great stuff. He's going to go. Now, he's going to leave at the end of 433. He's going to leave and go back to checking. That's when his governorship is up, or that's where his visa, his passport expires. He's got to go back and report to Artaxerxes after 12 years. So he's going to be gone, and things really deteriorate in his absence, and then he's going to return. So I'm just going to grab this verse, chapter 13, verses 6 and 7. But while I was while this was going on, the details that we're not going to read right now, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year, Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. So in 433, 432, he goes back to Artaxerxes. And while he's gone, all kinds of bad things happen. I mean, the Samaritans move in, the Amorites move in. There's compromise by the priests. That's when the book of Malachi is written. Well, in his absence, that's when Malachi starts ripping on the priests. Because the problem starts setting in. So I'll read this here again. But while this was going on, I was not in Jerusalem. So for 12 years, things were run straight, simple. No one was abusing anybody. If they were, it was set aside. It was taken care of. But now he reports back, and in the vacuum, in his vacancy, corruption rises up. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Sometime later, I asked his permission and came back to Jerusalem. Here I learned about the evil thing Eliasib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. Now, that means nothing to you right now, I mean, unless you know the story. But Tobiah and his family is going to be a problem for Nehemiah during this whole time. He goes away, and even as soon as he's gone, Tobiah, the priests bring Tobiah and give him access to the temple, give him a room, and Tobiah it shouldn't even be in there. And there's many things going to take place to kind of really set this up. So he comes, I'll just read it right here in case I don't get to it. So when he comes back, and he's sent on a second visa, a second time that he gets to come back for a second appointment, we don't know much about that. We don't know the length of that second time, but he does return because here he comes back. And now these next verses is he's on his second time back. 445 to 433 is his 12 years there. He reports to Artaxerxes he's gone enough, long enough for corruption to rise up, the priests to start renting out rooms in the temple. And then he reports back, and when he gets back, it's like, no, not on my time. I'm back, and here's what he does, just in case we miss it. Here I learned about the evil thing Eliasib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased and threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the room. So he goes in, and I don't know if you ever had teenagers and you clean the room for them. Well, he's throwing, this is, if you read it literally, Nehemiah comes back and goes, what is this? Well, we're renting rooms to Tobiah. No, not on the Temple Mount. And he starts throwing stuff out into the temple courts. He says, I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back in them the equipment of the house of God and the grain offerings and the incense. In other words, this room was used for storing grain offerings, for storing incense, and some of the equipment that was needed for use on the Temple Mount, whatever they were using, if it be the carts for the incense, whatever, they had. This was a storage room for the priest to use. It wasn't for Tobiah's own personal residence. So he throws it out and they clean it. I also learned that the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and singers responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. In other words, they began to abandoned taking care of the temple and went back home to start taking care of their own crops instead of staying here and being provided for by the people. In other words, the priests began to leave the temple because the people stopped bringing the sacrifices. So they have to, we're starving here, so they have to go off to their fields and make a living. And he says, no, this whole system is breaking down. So this is now his second time back. So verse 11, so I rebuked the officials and asked them, why is the house of God neglected? Then I called them together. Now again, picture the book of Malachi being right. This is when Malachi is prophesying, and he sounds just the same. Then I called them together and stationed them at their post. All Judah brought their tithes of grain, new wine, and oil into the storerooms. I put the dates right, the other things right there. I do want to read this right here, verse 14. You're going to hear this a couple times here tonight. Notice verse 14. After he does all this, notice what Nehemiah puts in his text right here. Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its service. In other words, there's a couple times where he does something drastic, and then he stops and says, remember what I did, O Lord. Remember this and give me a reward for me. I'm sticking. He could be being rewarded right here. He's rubbing shoulders with the emperor, Artaxerxes. He's got a 40-year reign. The stepson of Esther. Esther's maybe 58. If she was 25 when she got married, she's going to be 58, 60 years old during this time period. So he's got access to wealth, provisions, power. Instead, he's investing it into the city, and he's offending powerful people. He's throwing people around trying to do what's right, and he's putting his head on the line. And then he would stop and say, Lord, remember this when it comes time that I did this day. And it's just interesting that he puts that in there. Verse 15, in those days I saw men in Judah treading the winepress on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with the grapes. He says, and it goes on, now you can see some of the other things he does as far as setting up the observance of the Sabbath, which was important for, of course, the Jewish law. Okay, that is in his second return. I just wanted to point out those two verses. Chapter 5, verse 14, he gives you the 12-year period. And then chapter 13, verse 6 and 7 indicates he was gone and then he returns. We do not know how long he's back, how long he stays, but you can see very clearly he's there for 12 years, goes away, corruption sets in, he returns, fixes it. We don't know exactly when he got back. We don't know exactly how long he stayed that second time. It's not giving us there in those details. Okay. So let's go to chapter 4 and get some more information here. And again, like I say, I kind of wanted to keep the flow of this going. In chapter 1, 2, and 3, we have him coming back. We have him going on his night journey. He goes out on the valley gate down here, goes by the jackal well, comes by the dung gate, the fountain gate, and comes up here. And he has to get off of his horse at night because he can't get past all the rubble. Again, you can imagine, as if you've seen that, it was just a collapse. And all the rubble that would be here, he couldn't get through there. He gets right about in here and turns around and comes back in. And then the rest of the thing we talked about last week is all the men and families that were building on this wall. They all had a portion of the wall. It's going to be built in 52 days. So in chapter 4, if you kind of scan through chapter 3, you can see that's where all the divisions are listed on where the men were building and the part that they're working on. Chapter 4 now, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. Now, Sanballat is the leader of the Samaritans. Sanballat is like, he's like the governor of the Samaritans. He's the leader of the Samaritans. He's going to be important because he's going to be the source of a lot of opposition for Nehemiah. But there's going to be Sanballat the first, Sanballat the second, Sanballat the third. As we get towards the end of the book, if I hurry, there's a list of priests. Starting with Joshua, the one that we see in the book of Zechariah, and coming through others, there's going to be one of the priests there that's going to be the one who meets Alexander the Great when Alexander comes down. But there's also going to be one of the brothers of the priest that goes up and marries Sanballat the Third's daughter and builds his own temple up in Samaria. Or in a Samaritan temple in Gershom, up on Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim. And that's where Jesus talks to the woman at the well. Jesus says, should we worship here or worship in Jerusalem? And Jesus says, you Samaritans don't know what you worship. In other words, he just dismisses the whole Samaritan concept of their own temple. He says, and it says salvation comes from the Jews. So Jesus clearly sides with Nehemiah, Ezra, this whole thing here, and comes against the priest that went up and married in there. But that's all coming from this, going to eventually arise, that Samaritan temple is going to arise from this Sanballat and his family. He ridiculed in verse 1, he ridiculed the Jews, Sanballat of the Samaritans, and in the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria, he says, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Now, Tobiah, again, that's going to be the Tobiah, or a family member of Tobiah, that's going to end up in the temple. He's going to be the one when Nehemiah comes back after his absence. I think it's the same Tobiah. He's going to be the one who ends up in the temple, and he gets all of his stuff thrown out of the room, because in his absence, the priests end up renting him space. But anyway, Tobiah, the Ammonite, who was at his side, said Tobiah sided with Sanballat in Samaria. What they are building, if even a fox climbed on it, he would break down the wall of stones. In other words, he says it's so thin and so feeble, if a fox walked on it, it'd collapse. You can even see that picture, how straight it is and how high it is. It does, even when you look at some of the walls today, the walls seem like they're awful narrow. Like, remember standing on the Mount of Olives and looking at the southern wall of the Temple Mount today, it doesn't look like it's very solid. I mean, you hit a battering ram, it seemed like it would collapse. Of course, yeah, it's hard for me to answer that. When you talk about this wall over here, the broad wall, it's you can see how wide it is. I don't even want to say. You can see pictures of it in the Jerusalem book, but it would be as wide as these three tables. Like this. I mean, this wall coming here, built by Hezekiah in a time of peace, a time of prosperity, getting ready for the Assyrian invasion. So that's why it's called the broad wall. But that kind of gives you an impression. They call it the broad wall because it's a lot broader than usual. Sometimes when you get to the Herodian walls, they're going to be ashlars, are going to be maybe, I'm doing this, like, I don't know, the measurements, I've got the measurements in the book, but they're wide, and they're stacked up. But when they would build those walls, like the temple retaining wall of Herod and the walls that Herod built, they would build them, and we would see, we went down underneath, well, it'd be in this area here, down underneath, it'd be the retaining wall. We saw some of the foundation. We were underneath the temple, at the foundations of the retaining wall. And you could see that every time they'd put another stack on the stone, the bottom stone would be this wide. The next one would maybe be about, if this was, let's say it's 86 inches wide, the next one would be 84 or 82. And then it'd be 78. And so as you went up, It was built like a pyramid. You could see it. You could just see it. There's always be a gap stepped in. Look at the next one up. It'd be a stepped in just a little bit. So it was not straight. It was just tapered. So it would just give it a little more stability. It always got broader as it went down. And now we're talking about Herod's construction around this time. But yet, you can see on that wall there, the one that passed around, those are the stones that apparently would have been used at Nehemiah or near Nehemiah's time. And the reason we can say that is because, again, I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you, is the Hasmoneans, the priestly family, the Maccabees, who are from the family of the Hasmoneans, they're going to take over the priesthood and the kingship, basically. They're going to begin to rule after the Maccabean revolt, and they're going to start building some walls and fortresses. And they're going to end up having they're going to put an edge, a margin on their stones. But they're not going to have a flat, what they call boss, if you know what I'm just not what you came to hear. But a Herodian, you can see the stones that Nehemiah, they're square blocks, and they put them together from around 445 B.C. Herodian stones are going to have a margin somewhere between 2 and 5 inches right here. And this is going to be slightly raised boss, we're talking this much raised, and then it's going to be flat. So it's a nice looking, and then you stack them up. It looks very nice. The Hasmoneans, between Nehemiah's day and Herod's day, they have this boss, but it's unfinished. It's still bumpy. It may be this thick at different places. So I mean, it's not smoothed off. It's got the margin cut on it, but this is rough. So in other words, you can look at the different stones. You can clearly see a Herodian stone. You can see a Hasmonean stone. And then so it's easy to date the Jebusite structures. And then you see those stones that I passed around tonight. Those fit and are the style that they were building in Nehemiah's day. Plus, there's different things. They find coins. They find artifacts. There's other things that help them date it. Yes? Right. There was just stacked. That's why when Jesus says, not one stone will be left on another, they're not chiseling things apart. The Romans just come in and they pry it and just tip it over. Now, I'm going to go with this. Along this wall right here, the right here is Herod's retaining wall that made this a flat surface up here. Again, this is the top of a mound. It's called Mount Moriah, but it's not like, you know, Mount Everest where you have to, you know, get oxygen and tanks and scale up it and have. It's just a hill. Okay, we'd call it a hill, except it's a rock. Okay, so there's bedrock. So, but it's not even. It rolls over like this. So Herod would put this retaining wall around it, and they'd fill it in. And so this retaining wall, they could make this a flat surface where they could build on. Right in here, you can go down. This is where we came in, went in here, underground here, and hit the sewer. That one Sunday morning, me and Larry had church in the sewer. And we walked on the sewer up here. Actually, you start walking on the steps of the street, but pretty soon you're underneath the first century street of Jesus' time. This would be the street where the blind man would have walked down to wash his eyes in the Pool of Siloam. We're walking underneath that, and we popped up. This is where we saw these stones right here, underneath. I mean, we're like 10, 15 feet under the ground. We had to come up and pop ourselves up, and now we got daylight. We were underneath here. Instead of going to church, that's what we were doing. And that we saw these stones right here. We saw these Herodian stones. That's where we talk about you can see them stepping in. We saw this side. We didn't see this side. We were standing right here. If you go up here, you can access this, and you can go all the way up to this corner up here along this wall. Again, Herod's wall. You're walking on a first century sidewalk. In fact, if you look, get right to here and you look this way, you can begin to see the pillars of a colonnade. You can see the pavement, and you can see the beginnings of the columns that would have covered it up because you're in the sunlight in the first century. We're 15 feet underground at this time, but you're walking on the first century sidewalk, and there's a road shoots off this way that hasn't been excavated yet, but you can see because there's people living up on top of it, you see? I mean, you just can't bulldoze the whole place and turn it into an archaeological park because people own the property, and you're in trouble already if you get too far. That's why they have riots and all that. And can't you just wait for ISIS to get here? And what are they going to do with all this evidence? They'll just dynamite it, you know? But nonetheless, right in here, it's called the Master Chorus Stone. I'm sorry, this is maybe not what you came for. I wasn't planning on talking about this, but it's kind of interesting. You'd build these... Put the blocks here. Here's your blocks, your Herodian blocks or whatever. And then you put more on here like this. You're building them up. And how you're getting these people, how did you stack them? Well, remember, this is a retaining wall. On this side, they're putting dirt. Then they drag them in and just slide them over. And so over here, you're building a wall. But on this side, you're building a sand pile. You know, you understand what I'm saying? So they're not working on this side. They're working on this side of it. So if you look at it from this way, here's your wall going up. Here's your layers. This is now you're standing. Here's you standing right here. You're standing kind of weird. Okay, over here they'd be filling this in. This has got fill, so now it's filled in with dirt, gravel. Then they'd bring in another stone, roll it over, and now it's this tall. Then they'd fill it in all the way across the Temple Mount, bring in another stone, and build it like that. Do you understand? So this way, it's all filled in. That's what this is, all filled in. But over here, the Western Wall, you're looking at the Western Wall. Now, you do know the Western Wall is the retaining wall of that. You're looking at the retaining wall. You're looking at the side of a sandbox. You're not looking at the temple would then be built up here on top of the built-up rubble, have nice pavement stones. Does this make sense? Okay. When you get so high, let's say we start down here. Here's row number one. Here's row number two. And here's your stones. And it's just like playing with blocks with your grandson. Why did I say that? Well, I do that a lot. Okay. And you get so high, it gets unstable. So what they would do, they'd make one massive, like right here, this is the foundation. They'd bring in one massive stone that was so heavy, it maybe be twice as tall as a couple rows here. Like this big, like this, set it right there. That's one stone. It would be decorated. It would be decorated just like that. But it's a huge stone. It's like starting over. It's like, now here's your new foundation. The weight of it stabilizes all these blocks. But now you start building again. It's like having another foundation. It's like a second level foundation. And you'd, every once in a while you'd have a master core stone. Does that understand what I'm saying? The reason I'm saying that is you go underneath here, and all these stones up here, when the Romans, when Jesus says, not one stone be left upon another, they're just pushing these stones over. And you can see piles of the stones where they'd fall down and they'd break. But down in here, you can see that this, there's a master core stone right here. And it's chipped away like this. It's broken right here like this. This is gone. Because they couldn't move it. They could not. They got to this stone right here, and they're destroying the Temple Mount. And it's just one of those things where they moved it. They couldn't get it to budge. So it's like, we're Romans, break it apart. So you could tell they chipped at it. They chipped. These stones were all knocked off. These stones were all laying on the ground somewhere. They couldn't get this to move to finish up the wall. So they chipped at it. This is all gone. This is all chipped away. Today it's been filled in with new rock so they could, you know, see it. But or someone else built it in so they could rebuild what was left before it was, you know, in the ancient world. But they got this far, and they're just kind of like, this is probably what it looked like. It's kind of like, it's been 3 weeks, guys. Let's move on. And they got this far, and they just quit. They just quit carrying it about because they just couldn't get it. They couldn't get it moved, and they chipped it away long enough, and they just moved on. So again, you say, well, then Jesus' words weren't fulfilled. Well, I don't think Jesus was talking about every stone in the retaining wall, every stone that Herod put up would be destroyed or not. I think he's talking about the temple structure. This place was bulldozed, basically. The Temple Mount was, there's nothing left up there that's original from Jesus' day. Now, you can see stones all along here from Herod. The Western Wall is still standing. That's Herod's. Jesus could have stood right there and leaned against it, except he would have been standing down here. Because this is all, you know, junk filling up. Where we stand today, and that's in the book too, we're standing way up here on the wall. You understand what I'm saying? The sidewalk is down here in Jesus' day. But with rubble and years, now the sidewalk's up here. But this is still the Western Wall. So this wall is still there. You can clearly see this wall, and you can even see the steps leading up to this wall. So the retaining wall is there. So when Jesus was saying, well, not one stone will be left upon another, I don't think he was talking about this. Now, some use that. I got to get back. Some use that and say, well, then this must not have been the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount was this place right here. And that goes back to the argument you were presenting a couple nights ago. Martin presents that this large stone structure was actually the temple. And he's pretty much off on his own tangent. And a couple guys are following. Okay. Sorry about that. But anyway, that's interesting. There's some more detail in the Jerusalem book. You got a question? Did it make sense? Okay. It's interesting. I mean, if nothing else, it's interesting. Right? I'm looking for peer support here. Okay. You see me begging for some kind of feedback? It's something that's like, oh my gosh, are we done yet? It's like, okay, thank you. Hey, you can tell I've been with middle school kids. You know, they're like, you know, you're talking to them, they're like, you know, eighth hour of the day, it's like, and I'm talking, and there's no one in the room listening to me. We might as well just start working on machines or projects. Okay. Tobiah, the Ammonite, who's going to end up having a room in the temple when Nehemiah leaves, and Sanballat, the Samaritan, are making fun of the wall, saying it's not going to last. A fox could knock it over. So the prayer. Now, the next thing you have is a prayer. Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in the land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders. That's Nehemiah's prayer against the opposition. Again, remember, this is a time of God's blessing. We talked about this in church yesterday. This was a time, Jeremiah's was a day of judgment. This is now a day of Israel being blessed, and Nehemiah is going to run with it because the door is wide open. What God opens, when Jesus says, I've opened a door that no one can shut, he's opened a door, you just got to go through it. And Israelites are not going through it, and Nehemiah is going to push them through the door that God opens. And this opposition, God is going to deal with it. So verse 6, so we rebuild the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arab, the Ammonites, and the men of Ashdod, that'd be over towards the Philistines, heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's wall had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, the gaps in the wall were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet the threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah says, the strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. Now, what is this rubble? That's the rubble that I was talking about. When the walls are knocked over, you got to move all the stones out so you get back to the base and start building up. Sometimes you can use some of those stones again, but you still got to not just start building. You've got to dig it out so you get down to the foundation and start building the wall up. So they might have spent a lot of time at the beginning just moving junk away from the wall so we could come back. And they would reuse those stones. But they're saying the rubble is so great, the workers are. Verse 11, also our enemy said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to their work. So while they're busy working, we're going to come up beside them and just kill them while they're working on their wall. They won't even see us coming. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. Therefore, I stationed, this is Nehemiah writing, therefore I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. And I looked things over. I stood up and said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. So this is Nehemiah speaking to them like a leader, like a governor. It's not just, you know, he says, we're going to trust the Lord, but get out there and protect this. We're doing what God wants us to do. When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each of us doing his own work. Again, each one had a place. Each family was doing a part of the work. From that day on, half of the men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand on held a weapon, the other, this is a famous verse. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. So in other words, no one's going to sound the alarm except Nehemiah. In other words, the guy who has the fire alarm, that can call 911, is with Nehemiah all the time. I'll be the one who says, sound the alarm. I'll be the one who says, call 911. We're not going to have everybody around town calling 911 all day. I'll be the one who calls. Otherwise, we're going to have constant alarms going off. Then I said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. In other words, that was the sound. When you hear the trumpet, come to the sound, and we'll engage the battle at that point. So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. Those were long days. At that time, I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night so they can serve us as guards by night and workmen by day. So in other words, he's doubling up. At night, you stay in the city. You don't go home. You sleep here because now you're going to be sleeping and also being posted as a guard. And then when you get up the next morning, you're going to go back to work. We'll keep working it like this. Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. Again, he'd go down for water down here or went to the restroom. They had their weapon. There is no breaks. Imagine going getting that passed by the union. Okay, until this wall gets built, no breaks. How long is it? A couple of months. It's like, what? Yeah, just clock in. How many hours you work this week? Well, how many hours were there? Chapter 5. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. So now they not only have this is a great idea. Oh, wow, aren't these the great days? Yeah, but there's people still have to eat. There's still, the daily, day-to-day responsibilities. Others were saying, we are mortgaging our fields and vineyards and our homes to get grain during the famine. So it mentions the famine here. So it appears there was some kind of drought, some kind of famine. And so the people are starving and they're trying to figure out how they're going to survive this famine. Again, we have famines. We have dry times. The economy adjusts. But it's real different, I would think, in those days when there's no crop that year. And so they're trying to figure out. They're mortgaging their fields. In other words, they own property, but they're mortgaging it to someone to get money to buy grain. So in other words, they're giving up their possession. They're giving up their fields, their homes. And Nehemiah is basically, as we read this, Nehemiah is going to find out, what? What's going on? Well, we've got to mortgage our property. Well, let's read on. It says, still others were saying, we have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. So they got to send money to the Persians because they're occupied by the Persians. Well, they don't have money from working. They got to use any money they got to buy food, but they can't buy food. They don't have enough money. So they got to mortgage their fields to buy food. And anything else, they've got to mortgage it to pay the taxes back to the Persians. I mean, the debt is just out of hand. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. In other words, because of the situation, there was, again, a separation of classes. There was the upper class who had some kind of power, some kind of possessions, and they were taking advantage and mortgaging, taking all these fields from the average person so they could buy food. And the wealthy were getting wealthier, and the poor were getting poorer. In fact, they're saying, we're basically in slavery. Our whole lives are now to work this field to pay the guy that took it from us. And the guy that took it from us is not a Gentile or a Persian. He's a Jew that came back from exile. And it's just this taking advantage of the situation. Now you remember the book of Zechariah, where Zechariah saw a vision of the scroll that had a curse on both sides. It appears to be something out of the law of Moses, that anyone who uses this time to profit themselves is going to be cursed by God. This is a time where if you all pitch in, God is going to make you profit. God is going to prosper the people. Oh, so there's going to be a chance here to take advantage of it. And so they're going to start oppressing some people so they themselves can prosper instead of the people. And so this is something Zechariah had a vision on, and now it's taking place. Some people are using the others to prosper as God begins to bless the advancement of the city. Verse 6, well, let me read it up here. It says, some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. We don't have any possessions left. Verse 6, when I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. In other words, he says, why did this happen? How did this happen? He ponders it. He's very angry because of the situation, but he's like, what was the cause? How did it deteriorate to this where the people are owned by Jews themselves? So after pondering it, he figures out where he's going to go. He's going to attack the nobles and the officials. I told them, you are exacting usury from your own countrymen. In other words, the politicians, the elite, were using the other people to make themselves richer. Just exactly what Zechariah had warned against. You are exacting usury from your own countrymen. So I called together a large meeting to deal with him. Now you can see, he's got this how much power. All of a sudden you begin to realize, not all of a sudden, I've been trying to kind of make you see it or think about it at least. Nehemiah, the servant cupbearer, comes in with a cup of wine and then goes off and cleans up the tables. You want me to vacuum anything, sir? That may be the idea. That may be the way he presents himself. But now you see, he's back here with a royal escort, with military personnel, and now he finds out that there's oppression of the poor. He calls all the elders, all the leaders, all the nobles of the Jews together and basically chews them out. And they're like, you know, who are you? You just come in here, you're just a cupbearer, you're just a waiter from the king's palace. It's like, well, here's how they respond to him. So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and says, as far as possible, we have bought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. In other words, when I came, we started buying back Jews that had to sell themselves to the opposition. We've bought them back. Now you are selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us. You're the one doing it now. They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. In other words, when Nehemiah comes in and starts chewing on them, it's kind of like, that's exactly what our plan was. So I continued, what you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also leading the people, lending the people money and grain. In other words, I'm lending it to them. But let the exacting of usury stop. He says, in other words, now Nehemiah, he's got his own stash of cash. And he says, I'm lending it. The men that came back with me, we're lending it to the Jews. But we're not charging them interest. We're giving them, here's some money to buy some food. When you get back on your feet, pay it back. I give you $100, you're going to pay back $100. But there's no interest. So he says, you can help. You can hand out some money if you want to. and expect it to be paid back when times are good, but not for a profit to yourself. He says, you're using this time of opposition, this time of famine, so that in a few years, you'll own everything. Give back to them immediately their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves and houses, and also the usury you are charging them. The hundredth part of the money, grain, new wine, and all this. In other words, basically tells the bankers, no, you tear up those loan papers. Just give them the house. And the interest you charged them, give it back to them. Wouldn't that be a nice day? Wouldn't that be a nice day? And that's what Nehemiah did. He just takes the whole banking system and flushes it. Says, no, you own nothing. It belongs to them. And the interest, you pay it back. So they had some kind of records. Here's what they say. Not on your life. We earned it fair and square. This is a free country. We got, here's what they say. We will give it back. And we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. All of a sudden, Nehemiah, the cupbearer, is like, whoa. He just shut down the banking system and they says, yes, sir. Sorry. And they did it. Then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised, which was serve in the temple. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, and this would be a symbol, like remember when Paul, in one of the synagogue services, takes off Corinth. I think it was Corinth, where he takes his coat off and shakes it off and says, I don't even want your dust on my coat, and walk next door, and they began a church next door. And he's shaking off the dust and says, okay, I don't even, anything you've done here today, I don't want anything to do with it, and I'm gone. He does the same thing. He stands up and shakes out the folds of his garment, which is a symbol of, I don't want any, well, here's, I think he says it good enough. I also shook out the folds of my robe and says, in this way may God shake out of his house and the possessions every man who does not keep the promise. In other words, if you want God to shake you out of his kingdom, then just don't do what you said you're going to. Just don't listen to me. And God, just like I'm asking God to shake you out of his kingdom, just like I'm shaking the dust off my clothes. So may such a man be shaken out and emptied. At this, the whole assembly said, amen, and praise the Lord. And it ended with a song service, apparently. And the people did as they had promised. Moreover, from the 20th year, now he's going to talk about something else. From the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, remember that's the year I read this earlier, that's the year he shows up. When I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah until the 32nd year, 12 years later, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. So in other words, that's why I'm saying I think he lived in this palace. Because he is not the king, he's the governor under Artaxerxes. And this would be the place, this would be the normal place they would have gone, because this is the royal residence. They would have rebuilt it, and there's other indication that's the place. But while he's here occupying the place of governor, there's a natural taxation that they would pay the governor, that he could call the people, I need this money. This is, we're it'd be like, like we talk here about Congress and Senate, and they have like, they've got life insurance and they've got health insurance and they get paid the rest of their life. You understand? And somebody say, well, that's a lot of money they're getting. So, oh, they serve. He's saying right here, we didn't touch that. We did not access any money. We did not access any of the taxation to be taken care of as the governor. None of my men did this. We came in, we served, we did our job, and we provided our own way. We did not use the people to provide for ourselves. So that's what he's saying in verse 14. Moreover, from the 20th year, when I was appointed, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people. In other words, those who were there before me, they placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to food and wine. Not only did they want food and wine, we also need some cash. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. There's your term, lorded it over the people. Peter says to the pastors, don't lord it over the people. And here's Nehemiah saying, before I came, the governors lorded it over the people. Used the people for profit. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. I'm here for one reason, and that's to build the wall, not to make a career. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. In other words, so after 12 years, so you must have did pretty good for 12 years. I came back, I had no possessions. I didn't tax them, I didn't buy property. I did my job, I built the wall, and I returned. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table. Now, in other words, not only did I provide for myself, there's 150 men on my staff that ate from my table. And here's what he says. as well as those who came to us from surrounding nations, meaning when they have ambassadors come or visitors come, they would also be provided for in their, you know, in the complex here. Again, you've got to imagine that there's some kind of nice living conditions here, or quarters, I mean, at least rebuilt. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days, an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor because the demands were heavy on these people. These people are struggling enough without me saying, oh, by the way, I need to be treated like a true Persian governor. It's like, let's just get the wall built, get these people back on their feet. This is about getting God's will done, not letting Nehemiah live like a governor of the Persians. Now, here's one of those verses, verse 19. What does he say? Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people. In other words, I'm serving them. I didn't tax them. I took care of myself. I mean, it's interesting that he says, he's almost putting an estimation point, and I expect to be rewarded by the Lord for this. Now, well, what a nice gesture. Right. And I expect God to pay me back for it in eternity. Next paragraph. I mean, it's just kind of interesting the way he's doing it. I mean, he's saying, well, that's kind of selfish. No, that's trusting God. I'm going to serve here. Because I'm trusting, right, God? You got my backside in eternity, right? Okay. And in eternity, I would first thing I would do when I get to eternity is check out where Nehemiah is living. And it's like, everything he didn't take here, it's been doubled. And Jesus refers to this very thing here. And again, we can see Paul and others living the same way. Okay, chapter 6. I'm going to avoid the cheap shot. Some of the guys that are flying around in jet planes today, it's like, I'm going to check them out too and see where they're living. Because it's like, if you've got a jet plane, a person, and you're flying around in ministry, it's like, yeah, you're having your best life now, right? Yes, I am. Yes, you are. Because in eternity, you might be in eternity, but you'll be like sweeping the gold streets or something. Okay, chapter 6. It's like, what? Did he say that? Well, I don't know. It just would fit. Chapter 6. When word came to Sanballat, remember these guys, the Samaritan, Tobiah the Amorite, Geshem the Arab, the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates. Now remember, that's a stone wall, but the gates that are going to be hinged and shut are going to be wooden. So when it talks about burning a gate, they're not burning the stone. Of course, the stones would be charred potentially. But what they're burning is the wooden structure, the door that pivots, the gate that pivots shut, and the hinges. They're burning that so it no longer functions. So you can burn a gate, and then you can just enter the city through the burnt gate, or you can knock over a wall and go over the wall. So you could leave the walls intact, but if there's no wooden doors or gates, what's the good of the wall? And so right here, he says, the wall is built, but up to this time, I had not set the doors in the gates. Now, we're assuming someone's already got them built. Nehemiah just hasn't had them brought out and set in hinges yet. Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Now, here comes some intimidation. This is all taking place in like a 52-day period. They send this message. Come, they said. Now, this is, you just got to love Nehemiah. He's no dummy. He's not a foreigner to the strategies and the schemes of palace management and politics. So the Sanballat and Geshem, they send this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Hey, yeah, we want to have an official meeting with you over here in the plains. Nehemiah. But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? In other words, I really can't stop. I mean, we're on a big roll here. We're really getting stuff done. It wouldn't be right for me to leave this project and come down and meet with you. Four times they sent me the same email. And each time I sent them the same forwarded message. I can't stop. In other words, they're trying to get him to leave the city so they can do him harm. And he's not saying, I know what you're up to. He says, well, I'm really busy, can't make it today. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aide. This would be like his number one guy. This would be like one of his vice president or whatever. Sent his aide to me with the same message. And in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting a revolt. Okay, if you won't come down and meet with us, we're going to tell you that. There's some bad news about you leading a revolt against the Persians. Now, this is where it comes into play. Remember, the Persian emperor is friends or, you know, associates with Nehemiah. They work together. This was Artaxerxes' plan. This was Artaxerxes' approval. And he knows Nehemiah didn't come over here to lead a revolt. I mean, how Now, this is ridiculous, because how could this people, all of a sudden, they build some walls, and now they're going to lead a revolt against the Persian Empire? It's like it took Alexander the Great himself to lead his troops over, and was one of the greatest feats in history to defeat the Persians. These people can't even get the wall built, let alone get it built and lead a revolt against the Persians. Now, what's ironic about that is the same situation. The Jews tried to do that after Jesus' crucifixion in 66 AD. They tried to throw off the Roman Empire. If you look at a map of the Roman Empire at that time, then you find Jerusalem, and they decided they were going to revolt against the Roman Empire. And again, they did a pretty good job. I mean, it took the Romans 4 years to stop the revolts. I mean, they had some power going. But it's really amazing that, you know, that they would even think you could overthrow the power of the Romans at the height of their power. But anyway, this is the Persians. So obviously, this is a false statement, but they're trying to scare the people. Trying to scare, because here's an open letter. You and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king. You're going to try to throw off the name of governor and claim yourself to be king because it says, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. In other words, here's the prophets who are going to step forward and say, there is a king in Judah. Now, this report will get back to the king, so come, let us confer together. You don't want this letter to be sent to the king because right here, we've got a letter saying you're planning a revolt, you're planning on being king. In fact, we've got names of the prophets who are going to step up and say, there's a king in Judah again. Oh, it'd be terrible if we sent this email to Artaxerxes. You don't want that to happen. Why don't you come talk to us? They're trying to intimidate him because, again, that would insinuate the idea that the Persians are going to come down and stop this whole process. I sent him this reply. Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your own head. Now, again, if you think about emails, this is where you'd start forwarding messages back and forth and attach their email to it, attach your message, and just send it up to our... And, you know, you'd have their name typed in up here, and then attached would also be to Artaxerxes also. So they'd get the email, and then, oh, he sent the same thing to Artaxerxes. Like, oh, man, he sent our letter to Artaxerxes before we sent it to him. It's like, oh, my gosh. So they don't know how to handle Nehemiah. They were trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Delilah, the son of another name, who was shut in at his house. He said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you. Now watch this. There's times the temple... You should not think of it as, it is a religious sanctuary, but it's not a fragile sanctuary. It is a stone structure. It is, many times the temple was also used as a fortress. In fact, during the days of the Hasmoneans and the Maccabees, people are going to hide in the temple. This is going to be their fortress. It's like the last place to go. You've got the retaining walls, you've got the temple. And so this guy comes to Nehemiah and says, hey, come on here. He says, I know there's a plot to kill you. What we need to do is get you secure in the temple. We got to get you in the most secure place in the temple so no one kills the governor. And again, the reason he's trying to do that is now you've got Nehemiah, who's not even taxing the people, is going to run and hide in the temple to protect himself from an invasion. Well, if there's an invasion to come to kill Nehemiah and he's hiding in the temple, what's going to happen to everybody else on the way? They're going to be slaughtered. Now, this is right out of... the days of the Jewish revolt against the Romans. I mean, this is all that they'd hide in here. The last place to go was the temple. That's where they'd hide. While all the other people are getting slaughtered. So it would have been a huge disgrace on Nehemiah's name to go hide in the temple. Because now he's saying, they're coming, and I don't want to die. I'm going to go hide in the temple. Good luck. And they'd be slaughtered. Well, there was no invasion coming. So he catches on to that right away. But I said, verse 11, should a man like me run away, or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. He's just worried about himself. In other words, he said, I'm not going to hide. I'll stand right here and die on the wall fighting with everybody else. It's like, oh. So all the things that they want to angle at Nehemiah, because he's following God, because he's pure, because he's doing it with good intentions, all the political angles they try to move him around with, it's kind of like, I'm ready to die on the wall. It's like, I'm not going to go hide in the temple. Well, I'm not going to tax the people. I've got my own provision. It's like, they realize we can't intimidate him. We can't scare him. He's not going to do anything wrong because he's following God. So, verse 14, remember Tobiah. This is a prayer. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophetess, Noadiah. This was a woman, apparently, that had prophesied or fake like she is prophesying to warn Nehemiah. Again, here's a word from the Lord. And it wasn't a word from the Lord. They're just paying her to prophesy a false so he'd run and hide. He says, and the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me. He doesn't tell God what to do to them. He just says, remember them when judgment day comes. Remember that they tried to intimidate me, tried to intimidate the people. And remember she prophesied lies against me. Just whatever you want to do, Lord, but I want you to remember them. Which is kind of an interesting thing also. Oh boy, we're out of time. Verse 15. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul, which is 52 days, October 2nd, 445 B.C. is when it was completed. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. In other words, he gives God the credit. We organized it, we fought for it, but in 52, you can't pull this off in 52 days if God's not in it. Also, in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, the son of Ara, and his son Johanan was married to the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds, and then telling him what I said, and Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. In other words, not only that, he ends that section right there. During this whole 52 days, there's been people that are on Tobiah's payroll that are still working among us. And every time he gave a pep talk or gave him the strategy, they'd shoot off an email up to Tobiah telling him everything that Nehemiah is doing. So he had no protection. He had no strategies that were not exposed. So chapter 7, we have to pick this up next week. And this is when he's going to end up returning back. All right, well, hey, it's a great book. I mean, it's real interesting to see the politics of what is going on right there and the insight. And Nehemiah, I mean, what a great, great man, a man of integrity. Not only did he build the wall, but life has to be a lot easier in Persia. Wouldn't you think? Wouldn't it have been easier just to stay in the king's palace and serve Artaxerxes? What's your job? Well, when he's got a question, I bring him a cup of wine. We sit down, we drink wine, talk politics. I think that's what it means. Cupbearer, I think that's what it means. It's like, hey, Nehemiah, open up a bottle, bring it in here. I got some questions. And he'd bring in a bottle of wine. It was like, you know, vacuuming the carpet and wiping off table. I think cupbearer. When I have a problem, Nehemiah, more wine. Let's talk about this. And it would be easier than that than saying, hey, he brings the wine and he's talking. Remember how it starts. The king wants to talk to him about some of his issues. Nehemiah, you're not focusing here. I got a bigger problem. My city's not been rebuilt. Well, what do you need? Well, here's what I'm going to do if I can fix it. Well, here, take 12 years and go get that fixed and get back here because I need you here. So anyway, it's kind of, Nehemiah's, I think, similar to Daniel was with Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus and Darius as far as being a confidant, someone that worked with, not just someone that vacuumed the carpet and brought in, you know, carried out the dirty dishes. Again, I may be overstating that, but when you see how Nehemiah moves, he doesn't move like a waiter. You know, he doesn't move like a guy that just serves cups at a palace. He's moving, and he's got the respect. And you don't just pick that up on a horse ride from Persia over here, especially when you got a military escort. I mean, or the Persia. Okay, I'm rambling. I'm going to pray, and you can leave. Father, we do thank you so much again for your text, the scripture. We thank you for the word you preserve for us. We ask that we would examine our own hearts in light of what we see here tonight, that we would examine our own lives, our own motives, and that we would live a life that is pure before you, that we'd be productive as Nehemiah was in these days. And Father, we do thank you again for the opportunity to serve you in history, and ask that you would remember us as you promised you would in eternity. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time. No class, right, no class next week because it's a holiday. Thank you. Nice play.